Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us. As we talk a little politics, Brandon, so much going on, so
it's
much
a huge
national.
Week, right? Yeah.
Yeah, we still got, you know, the shutdown that will never end, a State of the Union that's apparently not going to happen.
The State of the Union is opaque, right?
That's right.
Uncertain.
We got lots to talk about here in Texas, but before we get to that, let's just start talking right in on some of these national topics. We had a big Supreme Court of the United States ruling against transgender people serving in the United States military. It's frankly a big win for President Trump, but there's still a lot here. I think it's a terrible ruling, 5-4 decision. Welcome to the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, because you just made the fifth vote happen for this.
Yeah. I think it's a win for the Trump administration, but a temporary win. I want to get your take on this. In effect, what they're doing is suggesting that right now it's the case that the president's policy of placing restrictions on transgender people from serving and enlisting in the military can hold. But there are other cases that are sort of working their way up. So it could be the case that this gets overturned in the future, but it definitely thrusts people who are transgender back into legal limbo. And I think, as you say, this is a test of the newly formed court, right? We've got certainly a court moving in a more conservative direction. So we'll see if this holds or the degree to which, you know, we have a real impact here from the Gorsuch and Kavanaugh new justices.
Yeah, the interesting thing to me on this, is aside from sort of the actual impact on those who were transgender serving in the military, is the philosophical argument that the Supreme Court is essentially saying they're deferring dramatically to the executive. This kind of portends what they might do in other matters that have been sort of held up. Essentially, what they're saying is the executive branch has tremendous discretion in how it exercises and chooses to exercise. President Obama had essentially cleared the way for transgender folks to serve in the military via executive order.
Yeah.
And that executive order was then essentially changed by President Trump. This essentially reaffirms that process.
Yeah. The future of the Supreme Court and the conservative politics therein are going to be about executive control, executive power. And I think we've seen a hint of how potential they're going to rule on these kinds of matters in the future.
Well, speaking of who gets to be on the Supreme Court, that's determined by the President of the United States.
We should have a game show.
I know. You know what? You talked about this last week. It's like another day and another five people get in the race.
Right.
This week, we've got three new entrants, well, two for sure, and one right on the cusp of getting in. Who is up next in the perennial reality show of the Democratic primary?
Spin the wheel. Figure out who's up next. Well, so Kamala Harris, who is a senator from California, she is an interesting character. She was the first person potentially of South Asian descent to be president. She's the first black person elected district attorney in San Francisco. She has, though, a record, which I think a lot of progressives look at with she's been pretty hard on low-level offenders when she was a prosecutor. There are concerns maybe she followed too much of the sort of tough-on-crime kind of approach. That, I think, may be a real liability for her going forward, but her story is really interesting. She's made it clear she's willing to challenge President Trump, right? She's one of the few people who came out and said that there should be some sanctions and some serious pushback on the kind of behavior the administration was condoning at the border. So she may position herself in a way in the progressive side, but she's going to have some serious problems, I think, working through some of the crime stuff.
Yeah, I think she is a formidable candidate. She's probably one of the big three or four major candidates to get in. And the primary and caucus initial states set up well for her. South Carolina is the third one, has the largest African-American population of the first ones. California is Super Tuesday now, March 3rd. And their system of voting early, they essentially start voting when New Hampshire votes. And so you're looking at a situation where three of the first five kind of favor her.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, she is the only major African-American candidate. We expect New Jersey Senator Cory Booker to get in. But she's got a national network. She's a graduate of a historically black college, university, Howard University. Mm-hmm. And she has a large national network that she can draw upon. We know that in Democratic primary circles, African-American women are a potent force.
Major force.
And I think so the advantage for her is great. On the issues on criminal justice side, I think she's sort of been a, shall we say, a more recent convert to progressive religion on criminal justice reform. She was a hard-nosed prosecutor.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's going to hurt her in a general election if she can make it through. And the constituency group that would be most sensitive to this issue are African-Americans, and that's really her base. So I think she's probably somewhat inoculated from it. We'll see how she does.
She's doing well in polling, right?
Yeah.
The Daily Cause has the straw poll, which they do every 2 weeks. She just announced she came out on top, actually, above Bernie and above Joe Biden. So she potentially has some upside. But she's proposing something like a $3 trillion tax cut, like the bill for her complete package for tax reform as well as for like low-income rent support and Medicare for all is a lot. I mean, is this going to be a problem for her in a general where people are sensitive to that kind of a thing?
Yeah, I think everyone running is ideologically very similar. And so I'm not sure if you have a progressive lane and a non-progressive lane anymore. I think everyone's progressive. It just really degrees. But she's not the only one to announce, Brandon. I know you are a proud graduate of Purdue University in the state of Indiana.
Hail Purdue.
That's right. The mayor of South Bend, Indiana.
Yeah.
Has announced. Tell us a little bit about him.
So we'll play a game, buy, sell, hold, okay? Like, are you going to buy, are you going to sell, are you going to hold? This is Peter Buttigieg, who is the very young mayor of South Bend. He is openly gay, and he has a kind of progressive vision, which may match the mainstream of where the party's going. So buy, sell, hold. What do you think?
You know, I'm going to go hold right now. He's a great speaker. He's a Afghan and Iraq War veteran, incredibly bright, incredibly smart. As you said, a progressive mayor in a very conservative part of the country.
Yeah.
There's a lot to like about Mayor Buttigieg.
Yeah.
I think the question for him is, when you've got a field of 20 candidates, how do you stand out when you've got large, well-funded, kind of larger-than-life figures? We just talked about Senator Harris. How does Peter Buttigieg have any chance of getting any oxygen in here? So I'm saying hold, but, you know, my heart says hold, but my head says sell.
It's going to be hard to stand out. He's going to require a lot of money to get his name out there in a way that is going to be a pretty crowded field. So I think I agree with you. There's another potential candidate. Rumblings are that Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, is thinking of running for president as an independent. So, buy, sell, hold.
Oh, I'm going to sell on him running as an independent.
Yeah.
If he runs as an independent, it might be the greatest gift possible to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
There's almost no chance he's going to be elected president. He's a multi-billionaire. I think part of his calculation might be there's no opportunity for him in this Democratic field. I would be surprised if he ran. If he does, he should run as a Democrat.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough sell. I mean, running as an independent logistically is really challenging, getting on the ballot and making sure you've got a constituency. If he runs as a kind of centrist style candidate, there's an appetite for that, but it's a really tough thing. The good news is he's got billions of dollars to use to figure it out.
He might not even be the only centrist billionaire running in this cycle. So we'll see what happens.
Lots of room between now and then, right? That's right.
Well, we talked about this before, this ongoing sort of battle in the Democratic Party between progressives and more mainstream Democrats. Speaker Pelosi, who's been rolling sevens at the crap table, winning on almost everything, has managed to do it again. She decides to put on three freshman progressives on the House Oversight Committee, kind of give the newer firebrand members. One of them is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, giving her another platform to kind of voice her opposition to what's going on coming out of the White House.
I think it's smart for two reasons. One, she placates some of the more progressive members by putting them on the committee, but she also has Representative Nagler as the head of the committee, who's much more circumspect about the prospects for impeachment and very cautious about the investigatory angle that they're going to take. So basically here, I think you're exactly right that Pelosi can have her cake and eat it too. And in that way, it gives her the chance to be able to satisfy both wings of the caucus and also proceed cautiously on these kinds of investigatory issues.
Brandon, there's been a viral video that I think has sort of captured a lot of the mood in the country right now. And it's involving a group of young teenagers who are there for the National Right to Life March from Covington, Kentucky. And there's this visual where they were in an altercation, or at least a standoff, so to speak, with a Native American protester. It's a very complicated issue. But one of the things that came about is sort of the initial rush to judgment,
yeah.
condemning the young men. And then now the picture looks much more complex. The moral of the story to me is just wait 24 hours, let all the facts come out before you want to issue condemnation. And I would argue that a lot of this really comes about because those young men were all wearing Make America Great Again hats. And that
right.
whole sort of political dynamic in here can't be overlooked. And it's now become, because that is a new symbol for kind of, depending on your perspective, mm-hmm. how you view the president, how you view the state of the country,
yeah.
how you view the direction of it.
Yeah. Well, there have been suggestions that maybe one way to do it is to bring in other voices. Stephen Colbert, the late night host, said that maybe we should have Cardi B, who has expressed herself politically on a couple of different big issues, do the response to the State of the Union if it happens. Stay tuned, folks. We're going to talk about that after Texas. But what do you think about this idea?
Cardi B be
the kind of conscience of the nation?
Oh, absolutely. Nothing says America more than Cardi B. I'm totally down with that. I think Cardi B great. It's funny, you know. It was. You know what? The Democrats have had could do far worse than Cardi B doing the answer.
Right, right. Well, let's talk Texas, Jay. Actually, some pretty interesting stuff happening. Let's start with an old beef which has become a new beef.
That's right, Brandon. Senator Kel Seliger from Amarillo was stripped unceremoniously of his chair position from the newly created Senate Agriculture Committee. With this ongoing dispute that he's been having with Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, he was complaining initially about being stripped of another committee assignment. On the radio, one of Lieutenant Governor Patrick's spokespeople had made a comment to which Senator Seliger had said that she could kiss his backside,
right.
or some variation thereof.
But literally that, though. Like,
literally, that's
it. Did not
it.
Use a swear word.
Yes, and Lieutenant Governor Patrick then issued a 72-hour ultimatum that he had to apologize or he would lose his chairmanship.
Right.
Senator Seliger refused, ultimately apologizing, but apologizing only to say he was wrong to call out the spokesperson.
Yeah.
The person he said should have been kissing his backside was none other than Lieutenant Governor Patrick.
Right. Well, keep in mind, our listeners are savvy, so they know the power of the Lieutenant Governor, but the Lieutenant Governor gets to choose all the committee heads. And so we'll talk more about committee chairs in a minute, but this is something which the Lieutenant Governor's got complete power to do. So do not anger them because they will take it out on you. And that's exactly what happened. But, you know, Jay, I'm old enough to remember a week ago when Dan Patrick made the case that the election was over and that the time to fight about these differences was behind us. And this was going to be the greatest session in the history of Texas. The team that we were going to go to war with, Republicans and Democrats, he says, was here on the stage during the inauguration. And not just a few weeks later, we have this high profile feud blow up. It's a problem for the Lieutenant Governor politically, possibly too, right? Because by the rules of the Senate, that they need to have 19 Republicans who agree to initiate a discussion about an issue, any issue. And Seliger is literally that 19th Republican. So what's your take on how politically this might play out?
Yeah, this is a huge problem potentially for the Lieutenant Governor. You now have the makeup of the Texas Senate as follows: 18 Republicans, 13 Democrats, and Kel Seliger. So he literally gets to decide in many cases the things that come up because that's been the rules. Now, there are a couple Democrats, Eddie Lucio, for example, down in the Valley, who might oftentimes vote with Republicans to pass certain things. But by and large, you're probably looking at a much more meat and potatoes kind of session form. And again, this goes back to one of the issues that's been talked about, which, and we've talked about this before, vouchers are essentially DOA this legislative session. Kel Seliger was against vouchers, and that is the root cause of a lot of the problems that he's been having with Dan Patrick. It was a school choice, I guess, day in Austin. They had a big rally this time. No governor, no lieutenant governor, none of the statewide officials really there except for George P. Bush. And of course, Ted Cruz was there. But vouchers, which has been the major issue in the previous sessions, is not even on anyone's list right now and probably has no chance of going anywhere.
I think that's a good point. This has been something which has been Patrick's bailiwick, and he's wanted to make that happen. I don't know that the reforms will allow that It could be, though, that he's able to use his position as basically being in charge of the Senate to leverage towards getting some kind of a nod in the area of voucher. So there might be something on this, but I don't think that it's the kind of appetite that used to exist. So I agree with you, Dennis Bonin, more or less shut the door on that. And he's always been somebody who's not been that willing to. In fact, we'll talk about committee assignments here in a minute, but he put Dan Huberty back on as the public education chair, and Huberty's been against vouchers for his career. So this is something which I think definitely minimizes and narrows the ability for vouchers to happen, but we'll see. Now, teachers were a big factor in the election, and I think will be too in 2020. So there's definitely a political side to this, which I think a lot of people are recognizing, and certainly Dan Patrick recognizes.
Well, Brandon, we just finished up the 2018 midterms. We've got the 2020 presidential elections around the corner already.
Hey, can we get some more elections?
Yes. You know what? You've asked, and we will deliver.
Yes.
We've got a hot, suddenly hot mayoral races in both Houston and in Dallas,
yeah,
the two big cities in our state. Let's talk Dallas real quick, and then we'll talk Houston. In Dallas, State Representative Eric Johnson, who has thrown his hat into an already pretty crowded field.
Yeah.
Interesting thing there, they have an election in May. And so this effectively ends most of his legislative session. You've got former state representative Jason Villalba is already announced in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be an interesting race. It's really crowded, no real favorite. But we're probably looking at that here in Dallas. In Houston, what we thought was going to be a pretty sleepy race, part of it's because of the firefighters' dispute with the mayor. Part of it's because, folks, the city of Houston can't seem to pick up your trash anymore. And then the roads are crumbling. But other than that, everything's fine.
Right.
The mayor's drawn two high-profile challengers, the guy who he barely beat last time, mm-hmm, Bill King, and Tony Busby, a celebrated trial lawyer, big contributor to Democrats and to Donald Trump and, mm-hmm, Rick Perry. He's had press conferences where he's putting out manure.
Yeah.
Suddenly, ethics is a big part of what's going on, trying to end pay to play.
Yeah.
Lots going on in Dallas and Houston.
Yeah, the Dallas race has really turned on development and the economy. The Houston race is more, I think, personal. It's much more about Turner and about the kind of ethics that people perceive to be lacking from City Hall. This is all going to get adjudicated, but I do think this is going to be a couple of really hot races. It also suggests to me something interesting about local government, especially kind of big blue city government. That is that these are really highly desired positions, and I think people recognize that this is not the kind of stepping stone that it was. Now this is really seen as the prize, and so I think that you're going to get a better crop of candidates, and in Houston we may even see more people jump in. So this is something I think which gives us a flavor for where Texas is now, right? It's much more urban, and so many of these big important decisions that happen in the state are happening at the city level, and we're seeing people run for mayor accordingly.
One of the biggest national issues has been how to deal with the problems of bail. Here in Texas, it's been a big issue. And in Harris County, we've sort of been front and center with that, where there's been ongoing legal dispute about an unconstitutional bail program that Harris County has had. Well, you had an election, you had a whole bunch of new judges.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, they settled that lawsuit, and you no longer will be required to make cash bail for misdemeanors.
Within like 2 weeks, right? Yeah, the newly elected judges basically decided to settle. So elections have consequences, clearly. I think we saw that here. For those people who aren't that attentive to what's happening at the courthouse, this is a really good example of why this stuff is important. So I think you're exactly right. This allows potentially for about 85% of people to be released on cash-free bond, and that's a lot, and something that definitely has to be structurally accounted for, right? So what you've got here then is effectively all these people who have to be kind of watched in some way, and that's going to require a lot more money in terms of the pre-trial services division of the county. So that's going to be a big part of, I think, where the resources are going to have to go to make sure that this is done right, because you can imagine it potentially going very wrong.
Well, but let's be clear about this. What was happening were people who literally were getting traffic tickets who couldn't pay, or they weren't able to make it to court. They were getting thrown in jail and sitting there for 30 days, 45 days, in some cases months, because they couldn't make bail. The system made no sense whatsoever.
Immoral.
Yeah, it was immoral.
Expensive, right?
Yeah, it was expensive. It was unconstitutional. They knew it was a mistake. They refused to settle it. Now they've settled it. And now we have, I think, we'll have a much better system.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about committee assignments. Now, we've talked all about bail reform, which everybody loves to talk about, right? The county courthouse. But committee assignments, although they're off the radar for most people, are really important because these committees do a lot of the actual work of what the legislature ends up eventually voting on. So let's talk national first, Jay. There are a bunch of interesting things happening for our many newly elected representatives in Washington, D.C.
Right. Two big ones for me that sort of jumped out. One was our congressperson, Congresswoman Lizzie Pannell Fletcher, here in the Houston area. She and Colin Allred from the Dallas area both got put on the coveted Transportation Infrastructure Committee. Big, big committee, both in terms of here in Houston. Well, you got Metro coming up with trying to put out a bond. We're trying to do big projects. Obviously, flood control and flood control related projects on the infrastructure side. Huge issue there. The other one that stood out to me was from not a freshman, but from Republicans, Will Hurd from the Valley area. He was put on appropriation. That is a key committee. You get no money for the wall, Mr. Trump, if Will Hurd has anything to say about it. And he's been put on there.
That's a pretty big signal from Pelosi, right? Yeah, so congressional Republicans, when they were in the majority, lost five chairmanships. So Texas really has lost a lot of clout. This potentially allows for there to be a building of new clout in the future. So that's something which Texas is able to, I think, hopefully set its tone in the future. The thing that to me stood out was a couple. Veronica Escobar from El Paso and Sylvia Garcia here from Houston, both appointed to the House Judiciary Committee. This is a committee which is going to do a lot of investigating of the president, which we talked about earlier. They also have issues related to immigration and voting rights. So although they're freshmen, right, they both have decades of experience in county government. So I think this is a really good move for them and really big for Houston.
Yeah, and on Congresswoman Garcia, the one thing, she also got put on financial services, and they run the National Flood Insurance Program.
Nice.
And it's important to understand because that's the agency that does the buyouts. And as we know, CD29, which is the area she represented, has always been hit hard by flooding. And that's where a lot of the buyouts probably need to happen. That's a big win for her.
Yeah. Well, so from gaining committee assignments to losing committee assignments, we have some news from recently broken from Sheila Jackson Lee. Jay, what's going on?
That's right. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee is sort of embroiled in, I think it would be fair to say, a pretty difficult situation and scandal. She's being sued civilly for a woman by a former intern that's claiming that she was fired in a retaliatory manner by Congresswoman Jackson Lee as a result of her complaining about a sexual assault that took place. She's named the accuser. Now, that was investigated and criminal charges did not go forward, but a civil lawsuit is now going forward. From her perspective, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee has denied all of it, but she has voluntarily stepped down from her subcommittee chairmanship on the Judiciary Committee and as the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus's Foundation Committee.
Yeah. Yeah, she's being frozen out because several other advocacy groups are asking that she step aside from other leadership positions. So this is an unfolding story, but something that is definitely worth watching given that she's fairly well known and really well connected. But it's interesting to me that this sort of sexual harassment issue has become really the new abuse of power. We had last year seven members resign and a bunch who didn't seek re-election who were involved in these kinds of sexual harassment allegations. So, and they weren't all Republicans, they weren't all Democrats, it was a mix of them. So this to me is an interesting dimension to the kind of Me Too movement, and I think we're continuing to see the kind of political impact of that.
Well, Brandon, apparently Fox News needs to come take a Texas geography lesson because they are under the misguided impression that San Antonio is, in fact, a border town.
Right. Can you see the wall from here, Jay?
It reminded me of Sarah Palin being able to see Russia from her house.
Right.
Yeah, it's just absurd. So for what we're talking about is Fox News is planning a big sort of town hall meeting where they are announcing that they're sending some of their celebrity type folks down to visit the border town of San Antonio. Earlier the president had tweeted out or talked about a wall in San Antonio. Folks, there's no wall in San Antonio.
There is no wall. Well, there are walls, but not a wall that would keep people out, right? There were the walls of the Alamo.
That's right. Yeah, as we know, that didn't keep anyone out.
Yeah, exactly. That didn't work, right? They should put a wall around Henry's Puffy Tacos because it's always a line, and I always hate waiting in a line. So I'm going to get Puffy Tacos more quickly. So I'm in favor of that, so long as only you and I have the key to get in, right?
Well, again, this just sort of reiterates, they have no idea what they are talking about when it comes to the wall, when it comes to Texas. This is sort of a giant insult, but it's funny, and so we make fun of it.
They're getting a lot of pushback from members in Texas, and they are trying to create an urgency and immediacy to this, and they've missed the window. It's not working. But speaking of that, Jay, we're in the middle of a shutdown still, as it turns out, for what, the fourth week in a row, right?
Yeah, so the never-ending shutdown is continuing. Doesn't seem like there's any end in sight. We alluded to this earlier about the State of the Union. You've got a situation now where the president wanted to do the State of the Union. Speaker Pelosi said no, and the president backed down, agreed to put it off until after that. You've got two competing bills going on, right, Brandon? The Senate, Mitch McConnell, the turtle has reared his head. He is allowing two votes in the United States Senate, one that is Republican-backed that essentially gives the president $5 billion for a wall in addition to temporary relief for DACA, kind of the plan that he outlined earlier.
Yeah.
And another competing bill, this is the one that's surprising people, that McConnell is putting out there, letting Democrats put a bill that essentially reopens the government, all facets of the government, except for the issue around the wall and Department of Homeland Security, allowing them to negotiate on this. Effectively kind of ending the shutdown. Both of them are going up. Neither are expected to get to win.
Yeah.
But it gives, I think, an idea of what's possible.
Well, that's the point, I think. And what they wanted to do was basically show the president that, look, your option is not going to pass. The Democrats' option is not going to pass. There's got to be some other way. So this is basically like a legislative way to send that signal. The Democrats in the House, though, have suggested maybe they are willing to put up some money for border security, like a lot of money, the amount that the president asked for the wall, but that doesn't include the wall. So the president's probably going to have to compromise if he doesn't want an actual physical wall, and maybe he'll get it. Let's talk about the State of the Union, though, and that's another issue, right? My thinking on this is that the president probably misplayed this. The State of the Union, although less watched than it was years ago, is an opportunity for the president to be able to command the stage and set the agenda. The Fox News of the border thing is not going to do what he needs to have done. He needs a broader consensus at this. The growing feeling is that the president is really at fault for this and will probably continue to be unless that turns. They haven't done anything to turn it. The State of the Union would do that. So I'm not sure that this is the well played by the communication side of the White House.
Yeah, the president needs to start looking and acting presidential, as they say. And there's probably no better venue and no better opportunity than the State of the Union.
Yeah.
Right? That famous line that, you know, the state is strong,
so
to speak. He can't say that, right? It's this right now, the State of the Union is canceled.
It doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. So
the State of the Union is canceled.
Yeah. So I think the path forward to me is that the president needs to be willing to probably get more money, as you said, for border security. More, that means more money for the Coast Guard, more money for technology for drug interdiction, more money for enhancements at ports and ports of entry. He'll get all of that, probably more than even he wants.
Right.
And he's not going to get the kind of wall that he wants.
And
I think he can get more substantively. That's one, certainly one tact. And then, but will that satisfy his base? Is he willing to compromise? Because it seems pretty clear the Democrats aren't going to, and frankly, the politics of it are playing in their favor.
The two ways this ends is that the Senate can find some compromise. I don't see that right now, but that's something which has to materialize. And or we wait until mid-February when the government officially runs out of money altogether, not just part of it. That's where you'll see a lot more pressure to get things done. At this point, things are still in a holding pattern, and everyone's being petty, and no one is winning.
All right, so last point here, Brandon. What's your guess as to when this ends? Are we going to see a shutdown in February or not?
I would say if I had to bet my own money, I would probably bet not until after the government runs out of money more officially, and then there's real pressure because nothing is moving, right? Little snippets are coming in about how the government's not functioning. Certainly federal employees are really struggling, and you know there are things like the U.S. Attorney's Office can't issue subpoenas for certain things, and there are nonprofits who are frustrated and not getting the money they need. But until it's wide scale, nothing's going to get done.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer and always ready with a speaking invitation, Ernie Manous. Special kudos to our web and graphics team at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, the gatekeeper, Todd Holstlander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.